Jonathan Cook is an independent British journalist based in Nazareth, Israel, whose work has appeared in the most of the major papers of the UK, Europe, and the Middle East. He is the first foreign correspondent to be based in an Israeli Arab city, Nazareth being in the Galilee. His first book, entitled Blood and Religion, The Unmasking of the Jewish and Democratic State, was published by Pluto Press in Britain in April and will be printed in the U.S. in July. It concerns Israel's treatment of its Palestinian citizens during the Second Intifada and the real reasons for the policies of territorial separation evident in the Gaza disengagement and the building of the West Bank Wall. He also has contributed to several other books and more recently to the Counterpunch website. He has his own website as well, and we will tell you about that at the end of the program. I believe we have Jonathan on the phone. Hello, Jonathan Cook.
Hi there, Jeffrey.
Good to have you. Since I contacted you last week about today's program, the situation on the ground in Gaza has deteriorated. As we have heard earlier today, Israel has launched an attack by air and land on the Rafah area, purportedly to rescue an Israeli soldier who was captured during a Palestinian raid on an Israeli military post on Sunday. On Monday, you wrote an article about that on the Counterpunch website, in which you took the BBC and, in effect, the mainstream media to task for not reporting the Palestinian attack in the context of what has been happening in Gaza to the Palestinians at the hands of the Israelis in recent weeks. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, yes. I was trying to make the point that this word that we're hearing a lot from the mainstream media, that this attack on the army post was an escalation, as it's referred to usually, was a double standard. I think that's the simplest way to refer to it, that lots of things have been happening to Gaza for the last few months. But even if we just look in the last few weeks, there have been dramatic developments, and that this context for what happened was not being reflected in the mainstream media. I mean, I can give you some examples which should be familiar to people but weren't being used as part of the context for explaining what's happening at the moment. One of them, has been the constant shelling and bombardment of Gaza, which has destroyed much Palestinian property and claimed many lives, traumatized children and so on. A siege, a blockade of the land borders, which means that vital foodstuffs and medicines are not reaching the population there. The attempt by Israel and the international community to starve the Palestinian government of funds so that the government there cannot run itself, can't pay salaries and so on. And something that I thought was particularly significant, but which was overlooked by all the media, as far as I could see, was that the day before this capture of this soldier, the Israeli army had launched an incursion and an infiltration into Gaza to arrest, capture two Palestinians who it claims are terrorists. And it struck me that there was an obvious parallel here between what the Palestinians had just done and what the Israeli army was doing. But nobody was bringing that to light. Why was this military mission the day before, this violation of Palestinian space, sovereignty of Gaza, not considered an escalation, and the attack on the army post was? So I wanted to raise those kind of issues.
Well, this brings to the point, when Palestinian suicide bombers have killed Israeli civilians, they're condemned. When they fire homemade rockets into Israel, they're condemned. And when they attack Israeli military posts, not just on Sunday but in the past, they have been condemned. It would seem that no form of resistance by the Palestinians to Israeli occupation is acceptable.
Well, I think that the problem is that the context isn't provided for most people trying to follow what's going on. The occupation is never mentioned. I mean, after I wrote this article that you referred to, I received lots and lots of emails from people saying, but the occupation of Gaza has ended. And that seems to be the mainstream view here. I mean, I heard Olmert saying again just now that he's not going to reoccupy Gaza, as though this military invasion is some break with something that's just a temporary maneuver inside Gaza, and it doesn't have any more significance than that. But, of course, the occupation is continuing. It didn't end with the disengagement. Israel is still in control of the borders. It is still in control of the airspace. The Palestinians don't have an army and not allowed to have an army. Gaza is also severed from other Palestinian areas, like the West Bank and from East Jerusalem. So these are all signs that there is no Palestinian sovereignty in Gaza, and the concept of the occupation ending with the disengagement is therefore meaningless.
Well, it seems, in fact, it's more of a redeployment outside a larger prison. I mean, Gaza's been described as even by BBC as the world's largest outdoor prison. They just simply rearranged the perimeters.
Exactly. I mean, although it concerns me slightly this use of this imagery by the BBC, this acceptance of it. It seems to be that people talk about Gaza as a prison, as though that's just the way Gaza is. There's nothing can be done about it, and I think Israel's quite happy portray Gaza that way. It means that there needs to be a solution, and the solution can't be one provided by either Israel or the people living in the Palestinians living in Gaza. It needs to be a regional solution. And I think that maybe the logic of that position leads us to other ideas that Israel is pursuing at the moment, other plans it has, which is partly what my book is about.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Why don't you explain to I introduced what the book is essentially about. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Well, what I was trying to do was to look at, let's call it the Palestinian problem, as Israel sees it, in its bigger context. What we usually do when we talk about a solution to this conflict is talk in terms of a solution to the problem of 1967, the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, as though that would solve all the problems. But I don't actually think that's the way that Israel looks at it. Israel has a problem in the sense that 1 in 5 of its population are Palestinians living inside Israel with citizenship, and therefore with rights. I don't say full rights, but they have rights as citizens. And they also had, until very recently, the right, for instance, to marry people from the West Bank and Gaza, and thereby gain them citizenship. And this was the only way that a Palestinian who has been displaced from their original home inside what is now Israel could regain citizenship inside the territory that was once their home. It would be Israeli citizenship. And so Israel has been very concerned about that problem, and one of the things it's been doing recently is changing its laws to ensure that there's no way that Palestinians can come and live inside Israel, even if they marry a Palestinian citizen. And I think this is just one aspect of various legal and physical maneuvers that Israel is making at the moment. And I was trying to look in the book at what the significance of all these different maneuvers were, and I think it's connected the disengagement and the building of the West Bank Wall, which is now obviously the basis for some plan that's going to be, is being called realignment or convergence. What was the thrust of all these policies? Where are they taking us? Where are they taking the conflict? Where are they heading the situation? And my conclusion was that what Israel was trying to do was create borders, expanded borders, to protect itself as what it calls a Jewish and democratic state. And therefore, all other issues were being made subservient to that idea, the idea that Israel must remain Jewish and democratic. And that, in my view, will mean the creation of something that Israel will want to term a Palestinian state in the longer term, in these ghettos that are left behind after the wall is finished, after the convergence plan is implemented. The same issue with the disengagement. And I think you can see similar things happening inside Israel with a series of ghettos being created inside Israel. There are 3 population Palestinian areas inside Israel, in the Galilee where I'm based, in the Negev in the south, and also in an area called the Little Triangle, which is very close to the West Bank, kind of the bank. And it's clear that Israel is trying to separate these populations. It's trying to create a series of ghettos. And the question is, why is it trying to do that? Why does it want to call these theories of ghettos a Palestinian state? And that's what the book is really trying to explain.
Well, it's interesting that there might be a connection with that, a subtext to this morning's attack, perhaps a way of torpedoing the signing of the prisoners' agreement or some form of it by a Hamas representative yesterday, which would imply recognition of Israel and therefore put pressure on the United States and the UK not only to lift sanctions against the Palestinians, but also to pressure Israel to sit down with the Palestinians for yet another negotiation period. But this would seem to interfere with what Israel's plan is, as you describe it. And perhaps, do you think that this attack had anything to do with that, the timing of it?
Well, I mean, there's always a way of looking at these things and arguing that Israel has other motives. It's always problematic to know what the thinking is here. I think one has to try and look at the long-term goals, and those are fairly clear in this case, that Israel wants to create something it's going to call a Palestinian state, but which is going to be a very feeble state. It's not going to have sovereignty. It's not going to be viable. It's going to be a series of disconnected ghettos. Now, the goal of that, I think, is a region, what Israel often terms a regional solution, which is the idea of hoping that Palestinians will, if they're given enough hints and pressure put on them, they'll start to leave. They'll start to move towards other areas, neighboring areas, like Egypt and Jordan. And it's a long, slow process of attrition. And that strikes me, what's going on now is part of that process of attrition, what Israel likes to call pressure on the Palestinians. Now, the Palestinians are obviously maneuvering, trying to avoid those kind of pressures, and the prisoners document is one of those ways of trying to maintain national unity, allow room for resistance in the face of the delegitimization of resistance in the international community. Whether it succeeds, of course, is another question. Yes, I mean, Israel has more weapons at its control. I don't just mean in terms of missiles and guns. I also mean in terms of its room for diplomatic maneuver, ability to, as a stronger side, to determine the way that this conflict is represented internationally in the media and so on.
Its spin certainly has had an effect in Europe in recent years, in which the European public was very sympathetic to the Palestinians, and even there were statements from various governments to put pressure on Israel, and now it seems just like the United States are being led around by the nose.
Yeah. You're suggesting that the Europeans are being led by the nose as well?
Yes.
I think that's right. I mean, it's difficult to judge how genuine the attempt to provide a workable solution for the Palestinians was among the European governments. I think that they were concerned because European publics have been more sympathetic, not to look like they were siding with the Americans, because it was clear to most Europeans that the Americans were not honest brokers in this conflict. I think that what we'll see is that the European governments will ride this bandwagon at the end of the day. I mean, it's easier for them to go with the idea of creating a Palestinian state. As long as Israel is terming what it's doing a Palestinian state, it claims to be abiding by the roadmap, then the European governments will buckle under and they will say, okay, this is okay. In the longer term, I think Israel will get away with this. It's a trick, it's a con, but I think that it'll work.
One of the things that I've noticed, I go back a few years, for about 16 months, Hamas observed a self-imposed unilateral truce and maintained that despite repeated provocations by Israel, including the killing of its militants. And this truce reminds me of the truce that the PLO observed back in 1982, or before the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, for over 11 months, in which Israel had also signed on. It was an American brokered truce. But this was seen as a threat by Israel, that if the PLO, the Palestinians, could abide by a truce and stick to their word, that Israel would have to negotiate with them. And so the invasion of Lebanon was unprovoked. Now we have the situation here where Hamas has really bent over backwards not to respond when you expected it to. And finally, it's reached a point where Israel needed to go in and really escalate the feelings of the Palestinians if it wasn't bad enough already with what they had been doing. How do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a long-standing policy as far as Israel is concerned. I think you can see all sorts of ways that similar kind of maneuvers have worked. I mean, even the founding of Hamas itself, which was encouraged by Israel as a way to undermine the secular nationalism of Fatah and as a counterweight to Fatah. These kind of divide and rule policies are very well developed in Israel, by Israel. And you can see it both inside Israel, in terms of its Palestinian population here, and in the occupied territories. This is one of the themes in my book as well, and it's one of the things that interests me, how much you can see parallels between what Israel tries to achieve inside Israel and what it tries to achieve in the occupied territories. And that's why the sense is that what we're seeing here is a consistent and coherent policy. Often people feel that these things are improvised and spontaneous responses, but I don't think that's right. I think there is a long-term strategy here being pursued relentlessly and ruthlessly and has been for a very long time. What we're seeing now, actually, I see as part of a continuation of the Oslo process, which was all about territorial separation. It was about creating some kind of space for the Palestinians that would be called a Palestinian state. Now, Oslo didn't work out the way the Israelis intended it, and so they had to reinvent the process in another way, and I think this unilateral separation is just another way of doing it. Because they couldn't get the Palestinians to agree to the terms that they were offering, they couldn't co-opt the leadership enough. Now they're doing it unilaterally, they're imposing it. But it's the same goal at the end of the day.
Now, you talked about the Palestinians inside Israel, who essentially who are citizens who remained, or their families remained after 1948. You made a choice to live there, which is where most Western journalists don't go. They're either in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, or the West Bank. They're in Ramallah. What has been the response so far, the quote-unquote incursion among the Palestinian Arab population inside Israel?
Well, you know, people often ask me this, and I get emails asking, why isn't there more anger, and why aren't there demonstrations on the streets here more often when these kind of things happen? And I think, actually, the Intifada has been a process of wearing down the Palestinian population here, and it's been very successful. A lot of 13 people died at the Intifada. When they held demonstrations.
Yeah, 13 were killed or shot by the Israeli police.
Right, by the police force, using very similar tactics to the army at the start of the Intifada. Anti-terror sniper units were brought in by the police to shoot at the demonstrators, even though they were unarmed. So although there are demonstrations here, there is a sense of anger. There's also a sense of resignation. But also, I think the Palestinian citizens here feel that outside of any process, and not obviously Israel has no interest in consulting with them, negotiating with them, or even using them as a bridgehead to negotiate with the Palestinians in the occupied territories, which is one of the things the leadership here would like to be doing. But also, unfortunately, the Palestinian leadership in the occupied territories has tended to ignore them when making deals with Israel, when signing agreements, and so on. So there's, I think, a sense of frustration here, and a sense of resignation, and a sense that they can't really get involved in what's happening at the moment, although there are obviously when Yassin was killed, there were big demonstrations here through the main street in Nazareth as well, but that led to huge protests from Israeli Jews. There were articles in the newspapers suggesting that the Palestinians inside Israel were not loyal to the state, which is a regular theme you see here. People stopped coming to Israeli-Arab areas, and Israeli-Arab economy is essentially a service economy. You know, it's providing falafel and hummus and fixing cars and that kind of thing. So if there's a boycott, which there regularly is every time somebody here shows any sympathy for the Palestinians in the occupied territories, basically there's a cutoff of funds here. Everybody else gets starved inside Israel, too, if you're a Palestinian. So it's difficult to assert your feelings or be vociferous without paying a high price for it as well, although not obviously as high as the price that's being paid by the Palestinians in Gaza at the moment.
You refer to Sheikh Yassin. He was the leader, Hamas leader, who was killed by an Israeli airstrike, which also killed a number of civilians a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yes. Speaking of Palestinian leadership, and sometimes it appears to be an oxymoron, and I and even without Hamas, from my own experience, the corruption that was became manifest within Fatah would have brought it down, or perhaps led to a secular rival succeeding it. But now with Abbas seems much more willing to criticize Hamas than Israel. He says seems to say very little about the wall, very little about land confiscation, and he must be seen by an increasing number of Palestinians as a collaborator.
Well, Fatah has suffered, as we saw in the recent elections, and it's suffered because it has been seen as collaborating, essentially. If not the resistance movements, but certainly the leadership. Arafat was obviously held together, the movement, but after his death, it was difficult to see what kind of strategy Fatah was pursuing in terms of resisting Israeli unilateral measures. Particularly the wall, I think, was the most grave one, and one that people felt really... the leadership was just not having a voice. It did nothing for the first year and a half of the wall building. It kept quiet while Israel was creating facts on the ground, which is what it's been doing for decades. So there's a huge amount of resentment, I think, and that was reflected in the election results. Now the Mahmoud Abbas is using the prisoners document as a way to compromise Hamas leadership, tie them in with him. Whether he succeeds and what and how damaging that will be to any meaningful attempt to resist Israeli policy is yet to be seen. But it's notable that already there's talk of creating a national unity government. How that will work out in practice, the terms of it, we'll have to wait and see. But the worry must be that given the pressures on Hamas at the moment, internally, inside Palestinian society, from its leadership, in terms of the loss of funding, pressure from Israel, the pressure from this invasion we're going to see. A lot of Palestinian civilians will suffer very extreme things from this invasion. Already, the electricity has been cut off. Water supplies have been affected as well. So Palestinian civilians are going to feel this very straight away, and. What effect that will have on Hamas, difficult to judge. At the end of the day, we have to wait and see. We have to see what happens.
And one of the problems the Palestinian movement historically has been that much of the leadership has been based outside of Palestine and makes political decisions and gives orders that affect the lives of the Palestinians while those leaders live in relative comfort. And sometimes it seems to be the case at the moment where a political leader, let's say Halim Mashal, for example, who is supposedly the political leader of Hamas, will make statements in Syria and Damascus that will affect the lives of Palestinians. And, of course, he's taking a principal political position. But it seems like it's very difficult to do from afar when you're not on the ground. I know this hurt the Popular Front and the Democratic Front in previous years when their leaders were based in Damascus and their people were actually on the ground in the West Bank and Gaza doing the resisting and living in that situation. You see this as a problem?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a problem. The Hamas leadership inside Gaza has to be sensitive to the people who elected it and who are suffering because of its actions, because of Israeli response to its actions. The guys in Damascus and Amman can sit out that whole problem. They're not affected by the storm. Their interference isn't always very helpful, I don't think. In the end, Hamas is going to have to find a way to deal with Israel. Israel, I hope, will try and find a way to deal with Hamas, but it's not looking like it wants to do that or it needs to do that. But Hamas needs as much room for maneuver as it can. It needs to judge the issues as they develop. It needs to respond quickly and flexibly to the situation on the ground. And it's to a certain extent, it's hands are tied by the guys in Damascus and Amman. And I don't think that's helpful to them.
What made you decide to settle in Nazareth? And how long have you been there?
I've been there 5 years now. And, well, it was partly accidental. I came out to investigate the 13 deaths we referred to earlier, which had had very little coverage. They happened at the same time as the killings inside the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, and were overshadowed by that. But it struck me as an interesting thing to go and investigate, because the army was protected, in a sense, from investigation. It was very unlikely that we'd ever find out what happened, why individual deaths occurred, who was responsible, whether the deaths were justified or not. There did seem a chance that by investigating the deaths inside Israel, it would be possible to establish guilt. It would be possible to find out who had done it and why, what methods they'd used. And so I went out to investigate those events, and I was I was shocked by what I saw. There was clear evidence that looked from civilians inside Nazareth and other cities I visited. But some months afterwards, the Israeli authorities denied that any live ammunition had been used. And it was that disjunct between what I'd seen and what I was hearing from the Israeli authorities that started to prick my interest about what I was hearing about everything else that was going on out here. As it turned out, because the Palestinians here are citizens and they have the vote, Ehud Barak created an inquiry, a state inquiry, to look at those events, mainly to try and win back the voters, Palestinian voters here. And eventually some kind of truth emerged, not the full truth, but some of the facts, for instance, that snipers and live ammunition had been used against the demonstrators. So it was clear to see that the lives had been kept both by the security forces and by the government itself. I mean, ministers like Shlomo Ben-Ami and Ehud Barak himself had lied about the use of live ammunition. And I think that's an interesting aspect of how the Israeli PR industry works here. They call it Hasbara, you know, advocacy for Israel. I mean, it seems to work at all levels, including the ability of government ministers just to lie about government policy, what's really going on. And if that's what they do when it's inside Israel, where civilians and citizens are being killed, what are they doing in the occupied territories where there's no accountability?
Well, I had earlier in my program in the time where I give news and opinions before I called you, I discussed some of the language Israel is using, the importance of using the word kidnapping, which implies a crime committed usually against a small child or against an innocent adult, and you sympathize with the kidnapped person, never with the kidnappers. And it's a common criminal crime, and the only soldiers who've ever been described as being kidnapped have been, of course, Israelis. They're kidnapped across the border in Lebanon, where this has been going on for many years, and Israel is fortunately able to get this their language used in the press. We had the occupied territories become disputed land, so now it's no longer, or the Palestinians are the one who claim that they're occupied, and you have settlements become neighborhoods. Everything gets an Orwellian slant to it, and the mainstream media picks it right up.
It's a bit major concern. I think the next one we're going to start seeing is this idea of a Palestinian state, you know, and it's not going to be a Palestinian state, but I think it will be called a Palestinian state. And then the problem will be the occupation is over, we have a Palestinian state, so why aren't the Palestinians keeping quiet? Why aren't they just putting up with their conditions? This is the manipulation of, by manipulating the language, you manipulate people's understanding of what's going on here.
You also actually, it's interesting, over the years, the Israelis have assassinated, what they now call targeted killings, have assassinated a number of Palestinian leaders, intellectuals, political leaders, who would have offered a much more intelligent and articulate face of the Palestinians to the world than had Yasser Arafat. And one after another was killed off, and other than one attempt in Beirut to kill Arafat by Ariel Sharon during the Lebanon invasion, they literally kept him alive because, as my own experience, the PLO security was not very good, and they could have taken him out, but he was like necessary. And I know Palestinian friends of mine used to shudder when Arafat would be seen on television, hoping he wouldn't put his foot so deep in his mouth every time. And now they have Abbas, and clearly there are other Palestinians. I know some, both in West Bank and Gaza, who would put a better face on the Palestinian struggle than Abbas or Saeb Erekat, for example.
These guys are possibly in the positions they're in because they are useful in this kind of way. Knowing how these politicians rise to the positions they get, it's difficult to know, but they do seem to be very willing to present a better face for Israel and not to challenge it on the core issues, where Israel is vulnerable. I mean, if we had a campaign from the Palestinian Authority challenging the whole concept of the wall, explaining to people the annexation of land in the West Bank that is a consequence of this, the illegitimacy of this whole process, then it would be interesting to know whether Israel would be able to manipulate the whole presentation of what's going on in the mainstream media as effectively as it does.
I know it seems that most of the protests, or a lot of the protests against the wall, is being conducted by anti-Zionist Israelis along with internationals and Palestinians, but they don't get much publicity, whereas, as you say, Abbas and Erekat rarely talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a demonstration every Friday at Belin, but we so rarely hear about it. Peaceful protests. Terrible things often happen to these demonstrators. They get shot at quite regularly. Israel, it seems, is using experimental weapons against these demonstrators. All sorts of weird and strange things are shot at them. They have sort of sponges which create a terrible pain and rash when they're fired at people. I mean, there's a whole laboratory of weaponry that's being tested out there on these demonstrators who are just trying to say that this wall should not be built on Palestinian land.
Well, in fact, the International Court in The Hague said that, but Israel has the ability to flaunt international law. I mean, for example, today's action was an example of collective punishment, which is a violation of international law. Israel has obviously been able to do that over and over and over again without any concern that they're going to face any kind of sanctions. What can be done to prevent that or to change that?
Well, I noticed today Ehud Olmert said that he was going to be taking extreme actions against the people of Gaza, and talked in terms of punishment to put pressure on the Palestinians to hand over this captured soldier. So he's even using the language of collective punishment. He's not even concealing the fact that this is collective punishment. But it doesn't seem to make any difference. He doesn't even have to distort the language here. Because the context has been stripped away. Nobody's talking about this in terms of the ongoing occupation, the lack of sovereignty, the lack of control Palestinians have over their own lives, the way they're imprisoned and besieged by the Israeli army. So that Olmert can use this language, it seems, quite easily and just not be held accountable for it. So I fear that there's very little that can be done about this.
It's also interesting that Hamas or the militants holding the prisoner said, we will exchange him for the young people and the women who are being held prison in Israeli jails without any due process. And of course, not only was that rejected, the media has actually minimized that to the point of not mentioning it, as well as, and getting back to Abbas, there are, 8,000 prisoners, Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They're never mentioned.
Women and children.
Yeah, and Barghouti, there's never been an international campaign to free him as there was, for example, Nelson Mandela, which I always found very interesting. It's like building campaigns around prisoners has been a historic way of mobilizing a people, and the Palestinian Authority has done nothing of that.
Yeah, because my guess is Marwan Barghouti is seen as a threat by people like Mahmoud Abbas. They don't want to give him too much help in... he's seen as the future leader, I think, by many Palestinians. Many people talk about that, seeing him if Israel ever releases him, of course, as becoming a potential president of Palestine. So he is a threat to people like Mahmoud Abbas, and they don't want to help him. I mean, it's interesting that he's kept very quiet about the way that that this document, the prisoner's document, which he was the main figure in terms of its drafting. Mahmoud Abbas has obviously manipulated this document to his own benefit, with the whole threat against Hamas of using a referendum to test the power of Hamas. And it's clear that this wasn't Marwan Barghouti's intention, but it's effectively Mahmoud Abbas has used this as a weapon against Hamas, and also I think partly against Marwan Barghouti. It's put Marwan Barghouti in a very difficult position as well.
Well, it seems you have three forces fighting against the Palestinians. You have U.S., Israel, and the Palestinian Authority, which just received a shipment of arms from Israel, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
There's no liberation struggle quite like it. Perhaps you could talk about the implications of that and if there was any response to that among the community in Nazareth and inside Israel, the Arab community.
Well, this shipment of guns to Mahmoud Abbas, I mean, I noticed Danny Rubenstein, his very senior correspondent with Haaretz, was talking about how damaging it is when Israel talks about strengthening Palestinian leaders. There's nothing that weakens them as quickly as Israel saying it's strengthening them. It delegitimizes him in the eyes of everybody that Israel thinks it's important to keep him in supplies of guns. To sign the weakness of his position, both in Palestinian society and the fact that he's useful to Israel. I mean, there's not much sympathy, it has to be said here, for Mahmoud Abbas. There's not a sense that he's a serious politician or that he has any vision of where he's leading the Palestinian people. And therefore, there's very little sympathy for him.
Well, he is. I mean, at this point, he's in such a position, and Hamas is in such a position, the people in such a position, that he's, in a sense, invulnerable at this point.
As long as he's being propped up by Israel, he does seem to be invulnerable. And the international community, I mean, let's not just blame Israel on this one. I mean, the international community is conspiring on this just as much to keep Abbas in place. Everybody seems to think that he's the best option. The question is, why is he the best option? He's the best option because he's prepared to, or he looks like he'll be prepared to go along with unilateral actions from Israel. And unilateral actions will destroy any chance of a viable Palestinian state.
Well, we're coming down to the end of a very interesting conversation in an hour. You have a website, and perhaps you could give that to people so they can go and check other articles by you and then get your book when it comes out, Blood and Religion.
Sure. The website's www.jkcook.net.
One more time,
www.jkcook.net.
They're very simple. Well, Jonathan Cook, I want to thank you very much for having been our guest today on Takes on the World, and I look forward to speaking with you again. Thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Take care.